A conversation with Matt Dunlap, Democrat for U.S. Senate. I'm Keith Shortall, and we continue our series of Your Vote 2012 candidate interviews today with Matt Dunlap, former Maine Secretary of State and founder of Maine's Youth Fish and Game Association. Dunlap says he's running for Senate to ensure greater opportunities for his 10-year-old daughter and her generation. Before he gets that opportunity, he'll have to win his party's nomination. He faces three other Democrats in the June 12th primary. Join the conversation. Email questions to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. A conversation with Matt Dunlap, Democrat for U.S. Senate. This is Maine Calling. Or call 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Matt Dunlap, welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Why should Democrats choose you as their nominee on June 12th in the Senate race?
Well, I think I'm the Democrat in this campaign who has really the deepest connections to the state of Maine. I was born here and raised here, educated here. I've established my family here. I've committed an awful lot of myself to the state of Maine, both in my legislative service and in my service as Secretary of State, but also as a working person, a person part of a working family. I probably most closely identify with the issues that face working people in Maine and America today. And that is exactly the entire purpose behind this campaign, is to do something to provide greater opportunity for Americans and Mainers to succeed in this modern economy. And I think I have the most to offer in this campaign along that line.
What can Congress, specifically the Senate, do to improve the U.S. economy and hence Maine's economy?
Well, that's a pretty complicated question, and a lot of it has to do with – and this is the core of this question really gets into, you know, why the U.S. Senate race and not running for something like a town council or any other vector where you can be a very, very effective servant of the people. And the reason why I chose to run for the U.S. Senate along this line and what Congress can do is it can have the greatest impact on the future of our economy through our financial policies, our trade agreements, the people we put in the federal courts, and that all that happens in the United States Senate. So I think that the Congress has a pivotal role to play in the future of our economy, and we've seen that as our opportunities have declined here over the last 30, 40 years, with some fairly poor decisions that have been made along the lines of some trade agreements and fiscal policies that have sort of run roughshod over the regular working people of the country.
Well, let's talk about free trade. Give me an example of a free trade policy that you believe hasn't worked.
Well, by and large, free trade is a great thing. It helps bring down a lot of barriers between cultures and countries and provides a lot of economic opportunity and savings for people here in America and abroad. Where it doesn't work so well is that we forget that those barriers were put there really for a purpose in the first place, and that was to protect American manufacturing and American business. And when you have a trade agreement that's ratified with, say, South Korea, a country that has been known to manipulate its currency in the past, or China for that matter, but South Korea in particular, that's fairly recent. We just spent $5 billion in taxpayer money to support General Motors, and that was very successful. General Motors is now once again the largest auto manufacturer in the world. But, you know, on the heels of that, you ratify a trade agreement with South Korea where they manufacture Hyundais, which are already quite inexpensive, and you're making them even less expensive, thereby out-competing American-made products here on our shores. That's the type of thing that I'm talking about, that our trade agreements really need to maximize the benefit to Americans, not necessarily our partners abroad.
Do you think that we should be use our free trade agreements to maybe better protect the U.S. manufacturing industry?
Well, manufacturing is only one element, and manufacturing has become kind of a catch-all phrase that captures a lot of small businesses and large businesses alike. But, you know, free trade can also help us with intellectual properties, protect our intellectual properties abroad, which has not been terribly effective in recent years, as you've seen a lot of the debate over the Online Piracy Act. That's rooted in our inability to protect intellectual property abroad. So manufacturing isn't what we were taught really in school, that it was necessarily an assembly line factory. It takes many shapes and forms now. But yes, primarily we're talking about protecting our our ability to produce products in this country and sell them abroad, that's been impacted by our inability to compete with cheap manufacturing abroad.
Now, when you were growing up near Bar Harbor, your parents had a number of businesses, but one of them was a small textile factory.
Yes, my mother and my sister still run the Dunlap Weavers.
Is it directly affected at all by U.S. free trade policy?
Well, that's kind of more of a niche business. I think in the early days, it probably was more greatly impacted by trade policies. When you get into the shift in textile manufacturing, especially in the Northeast and the Southeast, where we had so much textile manufacturing over the last 100 years, that vanished quite rapidly from the 1960s forward. Some of that had to do with some of our trade policies and overseas competition from countries like India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, where the technology, because of the inexpensiveness of doing business there, they were able to adapt much more modern technology than our mills were able to, and were able to outcompete those manufacturing centers in places like Lewiston. A small mill like the Dunlap Weavers probably doesn't get swept up in that. But I can remember the Stryer mills in Corinna and Orono that ran three shifts until the 1970s, and now they're just the place in Corinna has been reclaimed as a Superfund site, and they're now going to redevelop the long abandoned Stryer mill in Orono for some other development use. So those mills are gone, and I think it's something we never really did much to address at the time about our inability to support textile manufacturing in America.
Matt Dunlap, Democrat running for U.S. Senate, our guest on this Your Vote 2012 edition of Maine Calling. Join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. One issue for all businesses, big and small, is the cost of energy. What can we do? What can Congress do to, if anything, to lower that cost?
Well, the cost of energy is something that I hear most about from individual families, and the cost of heating oil in the Northeast. And the Northeast is probably over-dependent on heating oil compared to the rest of the country. Energy efficiency on the whole is something that we really need to make great strides toward across the board, whether you're talking about manufacturing and the use of electricity. Also, transportation and heating are the other two big drivers of that. You know, there's a lot that's happening right now with the development of tidal power. We've heard the controversy about wind power, and we've seen the investments in wind power. Nuclear energy is still quite controversial, but you know, really, what we need to do is focus on efficiencies, especially at the domestic level, the residential level, and look at alternative energy sources for higher grade manufacturing. Natural gas has a lot of promise, at least over the next 100 years, I think. As the technology improves for extraction of natural gas, it'll answer some of the very legitimate questions about how we get natural gas out of those areas that it's most remote and most difficult to extract. And I think once we get that technology in place, natural gas will be a great supplement to what we're doing now. I think we're on the right track that way, but we have to keep developing those alternative energy sources in order to have some success in manufacturing and in residential use.
Now, you mentioned nuclear power. Do you support nuclear power?
I don't. I think nuclear power is extremely expensive. The investments are extraordinary. It requires a great deal of infrastructure. It does provide a great deal of power relatively inexpensively while it's in operation. But the problem with nuclear waste is it takes really millions of years to break down. There's no agreed-upon safe way to dispose of it. I think the liabilities are just too great to have a grand expansion of nuclear power at this time when there are other undeveloped alternative energy sources that we have not yet explored.
We've seen Republican candidates in this Senate race voice support for example, offshore domestic oil drilling. Is that something you would support?
Not at this time, not given the fact that those same offshore areas also represent some of our most critical fishing grounds. And after what happened in the Gulf of Mexico with the BP oil spill, our fishing industry is just too critical to our broader economy to jeopardize that for a short-term gain in some domestic crude oil production. I would rather hold off until we have a better answer to that problem.
Would you support the Keystone Pipeline or similar projects?
Well, the pipeline itself is probably less of an issue than the tar sands oil that is being extracted to fill the pipeline. And that's something I think requires a much more detailed environmental discussion. The pipeline that's being proposed through the state of Maine, I do not support. I think there's too much risk going along Sebago Lake for an old pipeline that has not been updated in many, many years to then suddenly start using that for some of that type of use. We have to be, we have to be very careful with fossil fuels and energy production along that line, because the environmental impacts can be quite profound and sometimes irreversible.
But and specifically on price, is there something that Congress can or should do, for example, to interfere with speculation that many believe is driving up the cost of gasoline, for example, when tensions rise in the Middle East? The markets drive that up. Is that something that we should interfere with?
Well, that's an age-old question, and that has been a question that's been asked for many, many decades in the use of a market economy and the trading of commodities. And oil futures are considered a commodity, and their value increases or decreases depending on world events. And I think that may be part of what we have to live with if you're going to have a free market economy trading in commodities and futures. That being said, it seems unreasonable that oil that has already been bought, paid for, refined, and delivered suddenly becomes, 20 cents a gallon more valuable because there's a crisis in the Middle East. That's something that I think we do have some power to regulate. We have price gouging laws. They may need some more flexibility in application in order to prevent that type of speculation at the end of the pipeline. Speculation at the beginning of the pipeline is really part of the market risk that you endure when you're investing in and taking a risk in possibilities of the future.
And would you support tax incentives for oil companies, as we've read about, and tax incentives for alternative energy programs?
Well, I think the tax incentives that we provided to oil companies are rather problematic, simply because you have a very, very profitable industry now. Providing them with additional tax incentives seems a bit counterintuitive that we would be investing in that direction. In alternative energy sources, I think some of the tax incentives that you provide them should be short-term and experimental only. They should be able to figure out pretty quickly if an alternative energy source is viable or not. So having long-term tax subsidies for something that is designed ultimately to make a profit for its investors may be not the best and wisest use of taxpayer money.
All right. We spent a good deal of time here on energy. I want to talk about health care. Do you support the Affordable Care Act? And if so, why?
Well, I do, because it's a very, very important step to provide some security for people who otherwise would not have any access to health care at all. This is one of the things that I've heard the most about as I've engaged in this campaign. And this campaign is not all about doing radio shows and sitting on a stage at a forum. Much of my campaign has been one-on-one conversations with individuals and talking about the issues that are important to them. And one of the issues I hear most about is fear about our healthcare system and what will happen to people who do not have healthcare or do not have access to affordable healthcare. I talked with a woman not too long ago who was quite concerned. She had health insurance, she and her husband, and they're a little bit older. I wouldn't say they're elderly, but they're older. And she said it cost them $1,600 a month for health insurance, and they had a $20,000 deductible. Now, that's not really health insurance. That's actually just changing the portfolio that you have to file in a bankruptcy court. So I think the Affordable Care Act is an important step in a good direction to address some of those concerns. However, the problems that surround the healthcare access issue are so immense and so complicated that you can never fix them with one bill. And I don't think we should stop with the Affordable Care Act. I think we have to keep going and looking at the broader picture of how we access and provide healthcare through hospitals, through local primary care providers and those types of networks. And also preventative care as well. Make sure that people have access to screening, have access to counseling about diet, exercise, sight, audio screening for children. These are the types of things that we can make sound investments in. So I don't think certainly not all that is addressed in the Affordable Care Act. But like I say, it's a good step in the right direction.
What about mandatory coverage of birth control for entities that find that particular benefit objectionable?
I think that has to boil down to the individual choice. And I know that's been something that's been very controversial with certain religious institutions, especially, that may disagree with the idea of providing contraception. But when you're a national government providing a service to the nation's citizens, it really should ultimately be up to those citizens whether or not they access it. So I believe that, you know, in terms of the exceptions to that, if someone chooses to not access birth control that is being provided as part of an insurance package because of their religious beliefs, you know, I would go to the wall for that belief. But an institution saying that we do not want to provide that to our employees because we don't believe it should be provided, that deprives that individual of that choice, and I don't agree with that.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions for Matt Dunlap, Democrat running for U.S. Senate. Share your thoughts. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Hugh Laurie, the star of the medical mystery series House, which is wrapping up its final season. To play House, he has to speak like an American, not the Brit that he really is, and he brings down his voice.
The only way I can do it is to just completely let my throat go floppy and sort of wind up down here. I don't know why.
Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Weekdays at 1 o'clock, our public affairs programs offer a diverse selection of lectures, discussions, and forums on the important issues of our day. Many of these programs originate here in Maine at various academic or civic-minded institutions and organizations and are offered as part of our Speaking in Maine series. Not everyone can listen weekday afternoons, so our Speaking in Maine programs are archived on our website, mpbn.net, for streaming or podcast use at your convenience. To find the Speaking in Maine archive, visit mpbn.net and click on Radio or On Demand. Broadcast of Your Vote 2012 Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Garand Marketing and Communications, serving clients here and abroad from offices in Portland, Maine, the happiest people in business, Garand.com. By AARP Maine, working to protect Social Security and Medicare. More information online at aarp.org/me. And by Lambert Coffin, celebrating 25 years of delivering strategic legal counsel on issues and opportunities in Maine, with offices in Portland and Blue Hill. And welcome back. This is a Your Vote 2012 edition of Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're speaking with Matt Dunlap, Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Social Security and Medicare, often talked about in the same breath, Matt. Some say, you know, these are unsustainable. Social Security is going to be unsustainable over time. What can Congress do to protect that, or should it?
I think it should protect it. And one thing it could do to protect Social Security is stop taking money out of the Social Security Trust Fund to do things like fund the Iraq War. I think the Social Security Act was one of those critical junctures in American history when we had a choice between leaving people after having worked a full life, productive life, with nothing in their later years and providing them with something where they could live a life with dignity. And that's been the case now since the 1930s. And I think people have come to expect that that's something that they can rely on. And I think we, as a nation, we have to be prepared to fund that and prepare our elderly population to receive it and sustain it.
Can we increase the eligibility age and or incorporate some type of means testing to limit cost?
I would oppose means testing simply because it was always designed to be a universal program. And if you start segmenting who can get it and who cannot, it's going to erode support for it. And it's something that important. I mean, certainly you have people who are doing very well in retirement who you may question whether or not they need a Social Security check or not. Nonetheless, they've paid into it. I do support the idea of removing caps to how much income can be subjected to Social Security taxes. Right now, I think it's something like $110,000. Above that is not subject to Social Security tax. I think by removing those caps and having the wealthiest people pay into it, they are going to benefit back on the other end. It also helps sustain that for everyone else as well. But there are people, and I know people, who their only income after age 65 is their Social Security check. In terms of raising the age of eligibility, that could be very, very difficult for some people who simply cannot work past the age of 65 or 67 for whatever reason. And I think we have to be very, very careful about excluding people from that process.
So on the issue of taxes, do you believe that the nation's wealthiest citizens are paying their fair share of taxes? Should they pay more or less? And, we'll start with that.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, the top nominal rate for our income tax has dropped 50% since 1980. The Bush tax cuts have been in place for over 11 years now. And where are all the jobs that the wealthy were supposed to create? It hasn't happened. And in fact, our economy continues to decline. And, you know, it's bounced up a little bit this year because these things do run in cycles. But I don't think that's been because of tax breaks for the wealthy. So, no, I don't believe they're paying their fair share. And I believe that they can pay more. Whether it has to be the same type of rate that we had during World War II when the top rate was 95%, I don't agree it has to be that high. But I think it can those people who thrive the most through our economic system should be willing to contribute enough to sustain that system. So I do not believe that we should leave it alone.
Should we look at increasing the tax rate, on example, on capital gains?
I think we should, but we also, again, that's not a black and white issue because capital gains is now treated as a blanket when it should be a series of steps. Someone who derives great benefits, say, from a stock option and as part of their benefit package and they get a lot of money in stocks that they've done nothing to earn in terms of the money, they probably earned it through their work. That's a different capital gain scenario than someone who's got a family farm or a small business that they spent their lives building up and decide they want to sell that now to fund their retirement, and most of it now disappears in capital gains taxes. I think we have to look at these situations a little bit more individually than we have, and we can do that through a tiered system on capital gains that actually protects the American economy, protects investment, and rewards success in a way that it does not do currently.
To foreign policy questions, do you support the U.S. policy as it has been in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, because I wasn't, you know, in office for those decisions. You know, I think the Iraq war was a poorly thought out and not disastrous. I think we had success there, but it was enormously expensive. And I think we went there on a false premise. People were led to believe that we were going there to disarm a dangerous power from weapons of mass destruction that did not exist. Afghanistan is far more problematic because, you know, the Taliban were harboring the al-Qaeda terrorists that attacked us. And I think that deserves some response. Having a 10-year sustained response in Afghanistan, I do not believe is sustainable. That is, it is action that is critical to maintaining peace in that region of the world. But Secretary Robert Gates, when he left the Department of Defense, pointed out that we really need to get more help from our allies in maintaining world peace that we're not getting, and the American taxpayer can only afford so much. In terms of engaging in military action, whether retrospective in terms of what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan or any other place in the world that we're thinking about prospectively, we have to rid ourselves of the mindset that we're going down to the corner store to get a quart of milk when we're taking military action. These things are very, very long-term commitments. We still have troops stationed in Germany and Japan 70 years after the end of World War II. I think we have to be very, very careful about these investments and what they mean to our long-term commitments to our veterans, to our communities, and to our allies abroad.
Let's go to the phones to Waldo and Kathy. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. One regards Israel and the other regards drones. I'm going to go to Israel first. Israel is engaged in illegal activities. For one thing, the wall. The World Court has condemned the wall as illegal, and yet the United States will not, does not, ever criticize the wall. And it contributes to its continuation by standing with loan guarantees for what Israel does. Israel holds thousands of prisoners. Israel kills people in Gaza who may go too near the fences. They're scraping up material to try to build a home, which is forbidden to enter Gaza by Israel. Israel plows down people's olive groves, destroys villages.
Kathy, we're coming up on a break. I hate to rush you, but you have two questions. Can we fit those in real quickly?
All right. I want to know if, as senator, if he wins, Senator Dunlap would stand up courageously and tell the government, the administration, that it must stop supporting Israel in when it when it continues to do these criminal acts, which are also against our laws in terms of foreign aid.
All right, let's let him answer, please.
Well, first of all, I mean, Israel is our most important ally in the Middle East, and Israel has been subjected to a long, sustained number of attacks and invasions and terrorism for many, many years. That being, and I think we should support Israel, quite frankly. I would expect the administration to hold any of our allies and any government it treats with to certain standards, and that I'm talking about humanitarian standards, the way it conducts, those countries conduct themselves in their own foreign affairs. But remember, Israel is a sovereign nation. The United States can only have so much influence on how Israel or any nation conducts itself with its own citizens or conducts itself with its affairs abroad. As long as you have other nations that are saying that Israel needs to be destroyed and wiped off the map, I don't think you can stack the deck too hard against Israel in terms of its ability to defend itself. And I certainly understand the concerns, and I don't disagree with many of them. Individually, when you talk about destruction of personal property, the inability of segments of society to take a foothold and survive, that's something that is an area of tremendous concern. And that's what the State Department has to address in its affairs with Israel or any other country.
1-800-399- Yeah, sorry. Go ahead, Matt.
No, I'll let you go ahead.
1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Bangor and Bob. Hi, Bob.
Yeah. I like you, and I've liked your work in the past, but I helped elect a Republican governor because I followed the advice of the Democratic Party, and I voted early for the Democrat. And in effect, 61% of us voted against the governor, but because I didn't vote for the independent that time, who probably would have won, I made this big mistake, and I'm worried about making the same mistake by voting for you.
Okay, well, we haven't gotten to the primary yet, Bob, but Matt, I this is a question in the general election, as we know, right? So.
Well, it's actually an excellent question, and it's something that I've heard a lot of concern about potentially splitting the vote yet again and, you know, winding up with someone that many people find to be unsavory, shall we say. I think there's a less of a risk. I mean, 2010 was a very, very isolated election year. There was so much going on, so much public angst about the economy, about where we were going. And there was a strong anti-institutional sentiment in the electorate in the 2010 election. I don't sense that now. And really, Bob, it's up to if I am lucky enough to get the nomination, it's up to me to provide the type of messaging campaign to the public that they can rally behind and stand behind and feel confident in, just like the other candidates will have the same obligation, so that people can actually vote for something they want and not vote out of fear that if they vote for me, that somehow they're empowering someone else. That means I've run a pretty bad campaign.
Yeah, and we'll have lots of time this summer and fall to talk about those issues. Let's go to Auburn now and Paul. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, please.
You there?
Yes, Paul.
Yes,
go
here,
ahead.
Paul.
You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm wondering if we get somebody in the background of this candidate. Maybe he's going over it, but I don't have any biography. And what was his concentration to study at school?
You want to give a quick...
Also, what is he reading nowadays?
What's he reading?
Oh,
yeah.
Excellent. Two excellent questions. I grew up in Bar Harbor. I went through the Bar Harbor school system, Emerson Connors schools, Mount Desert Island High School. I went to the University of Maine where I studied history with a concentration in Roman history, did a master's degree in English literature. Right now, I'm reading a biography of Thomas Brackett Reed, the Speaker of the House, the U.S. House from Portland, Maine in the 1890s. Fascinating book. I highly recommend it.
Very good. Anybody at T.R. Reed, have you read any of his stuff?
I actually have read all of his writings about his trips to Africa and the West and some of his political writings as well.
You leave America?
Yep. Yes, I have.
Okay.
I've read that.
Yeah, we're going to have to take a quick break, Paul. Thanks for joining our program, and I hope you got enough of a bio there. We're going to take another quick break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, we go to famed Middletown, USA, Muncie, Indiana, for a portrait of tough times and Americans checking out of faith in almost everything. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join us for On Point this evening at midnight. Broadcast of Your Vote 2012 Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Garand Marketing and Communications, serving clients here and abroad from offices in Portland, Maine, the happiest people in business, Garand.com, by AARP Maine, working to protect Social Security and Medicare. More information online at aarp.org/ME, and by Lambert Coffin, celebrating 25 years of delivering strategic legal counsel on issues and opportunities in Maine, with offices in Portland and Blue Hill. Join us immediately following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock for It's Your World. The topic is the Middle East, a year later after the Arab Spring. That's It's Your World, immediately following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a Your Vote 2012 conversation with Matt Dunlap, Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate. Join the conversation, call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net or post to our Facebook page. You can also send us a tweet at Maine Calling. Matt Dunlap, do you support the 1973 Roe versus Wade Supreme Court decision?
Yes, I do. I do quite strongly. The time before that was a fairly dark period in the history of America for women, and not being able to have safe access to all medical services that they might need. And I think that the court decisions that have supported Roe v. Wade and the legislative actions been taken has been quite appropriate. We still have an awful lot to do on women's issues, and this is something I'm particularly concerned about because I have a lot of women in my family, including my daughter that you mentioned at the top of the show. This is about opportunity for all Americans and women in particular. That's something that's under great risk right now. And, the threats to medical coverage, the threats to access to safe abortion, the threats to fair access to the economy, that gets to the very heart of why I'm running for this position. Because, I would like to see my daughter, Emily, who's now 11, have an opportunity to live and thrive in Maine as an equal partner with the rest of her American colleagues and not have less opportunity to do that. So this is an extraordinarily important time in our history, and that's something I care deeply about.
Another Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, which placed limits on what government could do to limit corporate political spending, equating free speech and money and giving voice, I guess, to companies and entities to spend politically.
Yeah, that's a huge issue. We saw that happen in Maine last election where we had five state Senate races where the National Republican Party put over $500,000 into those races. And when you're an individual candidate and you're depending on $5 matching checks for clean elections funds, those people who provide those $5 checks are drowned out by those who can write $500,000 checks. And, maybe it's okay to have $500,000 checks written in campaigns, but we certainly ought to know where the money's coming from and who's providing it. That's just simple transparency. Freedom of speech does not always equate to secrecy. And we've seen some limits along that line talked about by the courts, and hopefully the Congress and the legislatures of this country will consider a constitutional amendment to modify that strongly about the role of corporations in our elections.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. To Gorham and Matt. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Matt.
Hey, Matt.
Hey,
great name, by the way.
I know. So I just had a quick question, and it's kind of a general one. What's your stance on gay marriage?
I'm a strong supporter of marriage equality, and my reasons for that. I've always supported civil liberties equality for everyone. I actually had somebody come to my office a couple of years ago when I was Secretary of State, and they were looking for some help. They had gotten married in their church, but because they were what we call a sovereign citizen, where they believed in limited interference from their government in their lives, they never filed a marriage license. Well, they had a long, happy marriage. The husband dies, and it turned out that he had some significant survivor benefits available to her through his military pension. But because they never filed a marriage certificate, they weren't really legally married. And what they wanted from me was a letter saying that, you know, they actually had been married, which I had no authority to produce, and nobody had any responsibility to acknowledge, and I might have been accused of misuse of my office for doing it. And you put that in the context of what the debate is about marriage equality, it's really about whether or not individuals can access a government filing to build estates together. That's really what we're talking about, and I see no rational reason, regardless of what a person's individual orientation is on marriage or gays or whatever, to deny those individuals that opportunity to derive a service from their government.
This is largely playing out in the states, at the state level. Matt Dunlap, do you see any chance for Congress to be addressing this particular issue?
Well, I do. And there's a whole issue with the Defense of Marriage Act, which was passed by Congress, where, you know, Congress said that they would not acknowledge, for federal purposes, those states' marriage equality laws. However, you know, it's kind of trying to have it both ways. I mean, when you talk about you're going to leave it to the states to determine whether or not they're going to allow marriage equality in their states. But then if they do allow marriage equality, the federal government doesn't acknowledge those marriages. I think that's not only fundamentally unfair to the couples, it also undermines state sovereignty. So I think Congress does have a role to play there.
A slightly different issue here. We have a tweet from a listener asking, what's your stance on right-to-know labeling for GMO foods, genetically modified foods?
Well, I think I think people have a strong affirmative right to know what they're eating. And whether it's genetically modified, use of pesticides, herbicides, we didn't really know a lot of this sort of thing when we were younger, when I was younger, back in the last 20, 30 years, 40 years, about what was on store shelves. And I think, just having basic nutrition information has had a huge impact. And I think having GMO label information gives consumers a real choice and gives a leg up to those farmers in Maine who are either going organic or some similar route. And that because, agriculture is a big reason, another big reason why I decided to do this. I mean, we lost 85% of our farms in 100 years and never did very much about it. We're starting to see that turn a little bit, but we need to do an awful lot more to support local agriculture. And having GMO labeling supports local agriculture because you can determine as a consumer what you're buying in a store shelf, whether or not it's GMO, locally produced, imported from abroad, or whatever. So I think that's very important.
1-800-399-3566. We're talking with Matt Dunlap, Democrat for U.S. Senate, to Auburn and Scott. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Hi, Matt.
How you doing, Scott?
Good. Refreshing to hear about the trade agreement that somebody's talking about this, especially where the college students don't have many jobs to go to. I hear your rhetoric about it, but what do you specifically think you can do about it?
Well, I'll certainly have a vote if I get elected, and I think it's important to note that I'd be one of 100, but I'd also be able to work with other senators, especially from states like Maine. I mean, Maine's not alone as a rural state that can be adversely impacted by unfair trade agreements. Trying to rebuild a manufacturing economy, getting people to believe that they can actually do something better for themselves tomorrow than they're doing today, as a new college graduate or somebody looking for work for the first time, maybe being out of work for the first time in a long time, that's pretty critical. And I think that as a senator, I can bring that voice of somebody who's looked at, when I left the office of Secretary of State, the only opportunities I had immediately available to me before I went to the Sportsman's Alliance of Maine were lining up nights at the restaurant I used to work at. And I had gone from being third in line for governor and having a master's degree to go back to food service, which is a great trade. Don't get me wrong. And I wasn't afraid to do that. But I think our young people ought to have greater opportunity. And talking about trade agreements and making sure that as we have those discussions in the U.S. Senate, that we keep those types of people in mind, as that's who's going to be affected by it. That's who we need to remember. And that's who we need to work for and stand up for and speak for in the United States Senate.
Scott, is that the answer you're looking for?
Yes, I was looking because we're losing too many jobs. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for joining the program today. 1-800-399-3566.
399-3566. Matt, you mentioned in that answer working with other colleagues in Congress. And one of the reasons that Senator Olympia Snowe left after so many years of service is that she was frustrated by what she said was the loss of civility, the my way or the highway attitude, as she put it, I believe. Is that an issue in Congress right now? And if so, what could be done about it?
Well, I think it is an issue in Congress, and I think you have to look at some of the history of Congress when we've had similar periods with similar gridlock. I mentioned the book I was reading about Thomas Brackett Reed. He went through something like that in the House of Representatives, where they simply had a filibuster rule that just kept them from getting any work done. And eventually, they found a way to change the rules. And I think some of these rules around filibuster and cloture should be modified, not necessarily abolished. But I think you have to, you know, what I learned, I needed to know about politics, I learned in the kitchens I worked in. It's really about working with people. And U.S. senators are people, too. And I have a strong record of that type of collaboration. And as long as I keep going forward on this message of greater opportunity for middle class and working families, that's something that exists in every state and I think resonates with every senator. And as long as we stay focused on that and keep focused on that message, we'll continue to make progress. And that's something this is one of the big reasons why I'm running. And as aside to that, because of the strength of that message, I've already received some pretty prominent endorsements from the Communications Workers of America, Local 1400. And recently, just this week, the League of Young Voters in Maine endorsed my candidacy because I'm talking about the same things. I'm asking the same questions they're asking. And we need to take those questions forward on the floor of the U.S. Senate and get other people to listen and work together to make things better.
We have time for one more call. Let's go to Portland and Lori. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Matt. This is Lori from Portland. How are you?
Excellent, Lori. How are things in Portland today?
Things are dandy. First of all, love to see you down in Portland a little bit more. You have my vote, no question regarding that. But I do wonder a little bit if you could clarify your position on gun control.
45 seconds, okay. Matt. Control.
Well, okay. I grew up on a farm. I chaired the Fish and Wildlife Committee. I've been an outdoor writer for many years. I believe that our gun laws in the state of Maine have worked very, very well. I know that gun control is an emotional issue around the country. I support the Second Amendment, and I believe in our sporting heritage, and that's something that I think also separates me from the rest of the pack in this field, that coming from the 2nd Congressional District and that rural heritage, I think that we have a very, very – we just ranked one of the safest states in the country again for the 11th straight year. I think we're doing pretty well.
All right, and with that, we are out of time. Matt Dunlap, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Matt Dunlap, a Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate. You can find links to our Your Vote 2012 interviews at the MPBN website and on the Maine Calling Facebook page. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Our volunteer Cindy Hahn answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board. We had additional help from the MPBN web team. And you can listen to this conversation in previous editions of the show by visiting mpbn.net. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.